Jesus summed up the training program that he carried on with the apostles in just one phrase. I think it'd be a good idea to examine that phrase and see what it says, don't you? I wonder if he measures up to our standards. John 17. Verse 4. The phrase is, I glorified thee on earth. That was Jesus' summary of his training program with the 12. Now you go home and examine the context and see if I'm right. I'm not going to go into it now, but that's his summary of his training program with the 12. Well, I'll give you a clue. Look at verse 6. I have manifested thy name to the men which you gave me out of the world. What did he mean? I glorified your name on the earth. This business of glorifying God for me for a long time was a total mystery. One of those beautiful phrases which meant absolutely nothing. It's like when you pray, God bless so-and-so. So I go over and I say, I'm here to bless you. And you say, okay, go ahead. So what do? I put my hand on your head and say something, or what do? I glorify God. What do? I go around telling people how great God is. Is that what he wants? Incidentally, that's a pretty important phrase to understand, because according to any good catechism, it says it's the chief end of man. And Jesus said, the thing that I did on earth was I glorified your name. And he used that phrase to sum up the training program with the 12. Now, what does it mean to glorify God? And how does he relate it to the business of training men? Well, the first clue that I got that my interpretation of the phrase glorify God was all wet was when I read in John chapter 12, where he says in verse 27 and 28, now is my soul troubled, and what shall I say? Father, save me from this hour? No, for this purpose I have come to this hour. Father, glorify thy name. Then a voice came from heaven, I have glorified it, and I will glorify it again. Which leads us to understand, Jesus here was talking about his death. And he said that his death was a part of the glorifying process. Now, what in the world is so glorious about being executed on a cross? So I got a clue that my definition of glorifying God wasn't quite correct. So I began to examine the scriptures to see what he meant when he said, I have glorified your name. And especially as it relates to his relationship with the 12. Because if he described this business of making disciples as the process of glorifying the Father, then that tells me what I should do as I disciple men, doesn't it? So this is pretty vital information, isn't it? Well, let's turn back to John 5. Verse 19, he said, truly I say to you, the Son can do nothing of his own accord, but only what he sees the Father doing, for whatever he does, that the Son does likewise. Now, when I first read this verse, I thought, well, now that doesn't mean that. It couldn't. Wasn't Jesus God? Well, here he's saying, I can do nothing of my own accord. He didn't say, I have resolved to do nothing of my own accord, or I have chosen to limit myself to doing nothing of my own accord, but what he says is, it's impossible for me to do anything of my own accord. And just to show that it wasn't a slip of the lip, which he didn't do anyway, but in verse 30 he said, I can do nothing on my own authority. Same thing again. As I hear, I judge. I don't use my own judgment. My judgment is just because I get it from someplace else. That was Jesus talking. And what's more, I discovered that as he described his relationship with the Father, and as he linked it to his relationship with the people around him, and especially his disciples, this was the essence of that relationship. Look at John chapter 8, verse 28, same thing. So Jesus said, "When you have lifted up the Son of Man, then you will know that I am he, and that I do nothing on my own authority, but speak thus as the Father taught me." So often our concept of the divinity of Christ is that Jesus was some sort of a superhuman walking around acting like a man. But in Philippians 2, it said that he put aside all of his authority and all of his glory, and he became a man. And as a man, he was dependent on his Father, and every time he said something, where did it originate? From his Father. Every time he performed a miracle, where did he get the power? From his Father. And you notice he said the same thing again. We'll skip over a number of them. Take a look at John 12, verse 49. "For I have not spoken on my own authority." Boy, if Christ couldn't speak on his own authority, who can? Nobody. "The Father who sent me has himself given me commandments what to say and what to speak." He operated under orders, under very specific orientation from the Father. Okay, why? Well, we find out what this is all about in John chapter 14. This is one of those intimate scenes. That's why I like John. It's really intimate. You get on the inside scoop, don't you? The last half of the book is devoted to the last week of his life, and it's mostly conversation. And here, John 14 is during that last week, and he makes a very strange statement in verse 7 of John 14. He says, "If you had known me, you would have known my Father also. Henceforth you know him and have seen him." Now, the Bible says no man has seen God at any time, but here Jesus just contradicts that. He says, "You've seen the Father." And Philip, remembering that, said, and trying to be discreet, and not trying not to contradict the Master, you know, that's pretty delicate, he said, "Now, Lord, show us the Father once, and we'll be satisfied. I hate to differ with you, but when was that we saw the Father?" And look at Jesus' answer. "Have I been with you so long, and yet you do not know me, Philip? He who has seen me has seen the Father. How can you say, 'Show me the Father'?" Now, how could Jesus say that? Every time he opened his mouth, what came out? Huh? The words of the Father. Every time he did anything, where did he get the orientation for it? From the Father. Every miracle, where did the power come from? The Father. So, of course you could say, "You've seen the Father." Because Jesus was the vehicle through which the Father revealed himself to the world. And that's what it means to glorify God. Jesus glorified the Father in this sense, that those men met the Father. They met God. And I like to think of glorify as just the word show. Just like the moon glorifies the sun. It shows the brilliance of the sun. And we see the light of the sun through the moon. Jesus showed us the Father. And as you examine John 17, you find that that's exactly what the process was all about. He said, they've come to know you, Father. And that's what discipling is all about. It is not getting men to be this or that or to know this or that. But it is bringing men to really encounter Jesus Christ and know Him intimately. That's what it's all about. And Jesus makes a transition here. And He says, now, this is what's going to happen through you men, too. In the same chapter, chapter 14, verse 20, He begins to make this transition. He said, now, you're not going to understand this now, but in that day you will know what I'm talking about, that I am in my Father, and you are in me, and I am in you. Now, just think of that. How in the world can we understand that? That He is in His Father, and we are in Him, and He is in us. So it's all mixed up. And we're one in Him. So that what can happen? Well, John 15 tells it. Verse 5, I think, is kind of the summary of the chapter. Where He says, I am the vine, you are the branches. He who abides in me and I in him, he it is that bears much fruit. For apart from me, you can do nothing. Now, where did we run into that phrase before? John 5:30. I can of my own self do nothing. Now, He's saying here that it's the same way with you. You can of your own self do nothing. As you hear, you judge. As you get it from me, you speak. I'd like to take you to one verse outside of the book of John. 1 Corinthians chapter 2, which kind of sums this whole thing up. And gives us the picture of what our relationship with Christ is really all about. Verse 11. What person knows a man's thoughts except the spirit of the man which is in him? Who really knows what's going on inside of Joe Holt, Jack Holt, excuse me? Have all these Holts in the navigation, you get them all filed up all the time. Jack Holt, except Jack Holt. That's what that verse said. Who really knows what's going on inside of a man except that man? Then he goes on and says, not the same problem with God. So also, no one comprehends the thoughts of God except the Spirit of God. So we have a problem. Over here we have Jack Holt. And over here we have God. Now, how is Jack going to get to know God, because they're two separate entities? That's why two people have a hard time getting to know each other. Because people are separate entities. And we're going to get into how to break that down. That's what the discipling process is. Now, God has broken it down for us. Because He says in the next verse, now we have received, what? The Spirit, which is from God. Becoming a Christian is the fusion of these two entities. Romans 8, 9. If you have not the Spirit of Christ, you are none of His. And a Christian is one who has the Spirit of Christ in him. Now remember, Jesus said in John 16, He said, now it's better for you fellows that I go away. I used to think it'd be kind of neat to be one of the apostles. You know, go through the cornfields and eat corn and get everybody all riled up and sit and listen to them talk go swimming on Saturday and get people upset about that and a few other things get it straight from the Master's mouth. And I used to think, boy, that would really be an advantage. But Jesus says, no, it's a disadvantage for you guys to have me around. Why? Because His relationship with those men was like this. Two beings. And He could only get so close to those two beings, to those other men. But he said, now I need to go away so that I can get rid of this body, so that we can really get together. And so, men, we've got it over the apostles. And what Jesus did when he trained those men was he introduced them to the Father, and by his constantly walking in this relationship of dependence on the Father, those men came to know God intimately. And it's up to us, men. We need to walk constantly in this relationship of dependence on the Father if the men around us are going to come to know Christ intimately. Why is that? There's a very interesting verse in 1 John 1:7. I'd like to have all of us turn to it. 1 John 1:7. I'll develop this thought a little bit farther. It says, if we walk in the light, as he is in the light, we have fellowship with God. This verse has kind of a strange ending, doesn't it? It would make more sense if it read that way, wouldn't it? We walk in the light with God, we have fellowship with God. But it says, no, if we walk in the light, as he is in the light, which I think is another way of describing the process that took place between Jesus and the Father, the relationship between Jesus and the Father, and the relationship that should take place between us and Christ, walking in the light. It says, then we have fellowship one with another. What does walking in the light, having this relationship of dependence and intimacy with Jesus Christ, have to do with our having fellowship with another? What does that have to do with my relationship to any one of you fellows here? Well, it has everything to do with it. And the man that I'm trying to disciple, I can't even have a decent relationship with him if I don't have that kind of a relationship with Christ. Why? What happens when a man encounters Christ? Well, that's a very uncomfortable experience, as probably all of you men know. What happened when Isaiah encountered Christ? He said, woe is me. Ezekiel, on his face. Daniel, God says, what are you doing laying on your face? Get up. John, I fell down as one dead. Why? What do we see when we get in that light? John 3:19. Our deeds become known. To whom? To us. And how does that make you feel when your deeds become known to you? Well, the first thing that I discover when I walk in the presence of Christ is that I am certainly not the infallible standard of godliness for other people. I become very aware of my sinfulness, and I realize that I am alive by the sheer grace of God. I'm unmasked in God's presence. Paul Tournier points out, in all of his books actually, that we all present what he calls the personage. Jung called it the persona, the person. What happens? Well, I project an image. There's a certain Jim Peterson that I want you men to see. And I want you to impress you that Jim Peterson is a certain type of guy. But the Jim Peterson that I present to you is not the real Jim Peterson. I wouldn't dare let you see the real Jim Peterson. You know why? Because it would be humiliating. And so I go around holding out my image. to everybody, and people see this projection that I am making, and nobody really gets to know what's behind it. I'm hiding behind this thing that you see. What's the result? Nobody knows me. I remain a stranger. And there's no real contact or communication between any of us. One guy presents an image, he's a tough guy. Another guy presents an image, he's an intellectual. And so on. And we keep trying to hide behind those images. I'll never forget my first nav home. 1958. I bet you a nav home had never been started like that one before or since. Bob Glottner was getting married, and he had a house full of men that I had never laid eyes on in my life. Well, he didn't want to run a nav home and get married at the same time, which is very understandable. So he asked me to take the nav home. So I rented a great big three-story house with a basement and an attic, and six men moved in. They were all strangers to me. Now, we did everything right. Every man had an area that he kept clean. Nobody passed a burned-out light bulb without taking it out and putting a new one in. We had breakfast at the austere hour of 6:30 in the morning. Everybody showed up on time with good attitudes. We folded up our towels three ways and always, you know, wiped around the bowl and all that kind of stuff. We had home night. We get together and we talk about the little frictions that went on between us. We discuss the ministry. We'd pray and we'd have a Bible study. Our Bible studies would run a good, healthy 2 hours. I met man-to-man with every one of those guys. We get together, I'd say, how are your verses? We check out the verses. I'd say, what'd you get out of your quiet time this morning? He'd tell me what he got out of his quiet time this morning. Then I'd check up a few more things. I'd give him some more instruction. We'd pray, and then off he'd go. Next! And then next guy'd come in. Those men lived with me for a year. You know what it was? Strangers in, strangers out. I spent time with him man-to-man. We lived together, all the little frictions and everything else. But I didn't know those men when they left. You know why? I wanted those guys to think I was a navigator. So I was wearing the navigator image. And so I'd run around the house with my navigator image out. And no one could get around that behind that thing to see me. And you know what? Those guys played the role of good navigator home dwellers. And so they went around with their navigator home dweller images, you know, out in front. And we spent that year, and I never saw them, and they never saw me. You know why? Because I was trying to glorify myself and not Jesus Christ. And so no fellowship took place. It was all very neat and all very sterile. But what happens when we come into the light is we lose that mania to project that image because we know it's no use. God sees us anyway. And what happens is we begin to be transparent before God, and it becomes possible to be transparent before the men around us. It's called, men, becoming authentic. I'll never forget, in about 1959, Denny Repko said something once that really stuck. He said, you know, if I had 30 minutes with the Apostle Paul, I wouldn't want to know about his great victories. You know, how he got up after getting stoned and, you know, brushed himself off, went on to the next town, or any of that kind of stuff. I would like to know about his weaknesses. I'd like to say, Paul, didn't you ever get discouraged? What did you used to worry about? Did you ever feel embarrassed about being in Christian work? But you know, and I think it would be more encouraging to hear him tell about his weaknesses than about his great victories, wouldn't it? But you know, I don't think that we'd even have to ask him, fellas. Because he was so transparent, he wrote it down for all posterity. He said, I was with you in weakness and in fear and in much trembling, and you saw what kind of people we were. And another place he says, now I know I'm no speaker. Another place he says, my critics say that it's as if he has no presence. You know, you come into a room and someone says, the Apostle Paul is here. Oh yeah? Where? There are 100 men in the room, and we go through all the 100, and the 100th one is him, and you say, well, it can't be him, I won't even ask. Yeah, but that was him. Nothing impressive about the Apostle Paul. And another place, he said, we were scared out of our wits. We were pressured above measure. And we despaired even of our lives. Yes, sir, those guys were really scared. If I didn't tell them, never fear, old Paul is here, why, they would have just punted. No, he said, I got scared. And he says, now, if you're going to push me, if you're going to make me glory in something, I'll tell you about my weaknesses. It was that basket incident where I had to escape, you know, at night, getting down the wall, and off I went, sneaking off into the bush with the guys hunting for me. He was candid about his weaknesses. You know, at first, when I began to study the Bible, I didn't like Paul. You know why? I thought he was a stuffed shirt. He was always talking about how great he was. But then I saw this side of him. And I realized that he wasn't a stuffed shirt. He wasn't proud. He was just honest. And because he could be honest and frank about his weaknesses without embarrassment and shame, he could be honest and frank about his strength without pride. He was authentic. And that's why he was a great discipler of men. I'm glad that the fellowship book is in the wheel, man, because I believe that it is the foundation of the ministry of discipling. Of course, it all depends on your definition of fellowship, doesn't it? It's not, as someone said, coffee and a donut in a church basement, is it? It's more than that. It comes across better in Portuguese. It's comunión, or communion. What it means is having all things in common. That's what fellowship is. Having all things in common. What do I have in common? My possessions? That's not much. My time? That's not much either. What do I have in common? What do I share with another man? I share my life. I open up my life. I take off the mask, and a man can see inside. Now that is a frightening experience. You become very vulnerable. And when you first begin to open up to a man like that, you're opening yourself up to an attack. But what the Bible says is that if we walk in the light, as he is in the light, then what happens is we are able to take that mask off and let men come in and have our lives in common with them. And that's the only meaningful relationship that we can establish with anybody. Otherwise, men, it'll be strangers in, strangers out. Now, how does this affect our relationship with men? What difference does this make? Well, the first thing, something I already mentioned, is that as we are in the light, and as we see ourselves in the raw glare of God's perfection, and see our imperfection, it really has an effect on our judgmental attitude. We cease to judge men. How can you judge a man when you see what you really are? a verse that has had a profound effect on my life is Ephesians 4:32. And be kind one to another, tender-hearted, forgiving one another, even as God, for Christ's sake, has forgiven you. And that last phrase really sticks in my heart. Forgive one another. How? As God, for Christ's sake, has forgiven you. Now, God has blessed my life. I can't figure that out, man. Because if I were God, I sure wouldn't bless me. Because my sin is ever before me. And I know this, that God is with me because of his great mercy. And how should I treat the men around me? With that same great mercy. Forgive other men, relate myself to other men as God relates himself to me. What happens to this relationship with another man when I'm that way with him? But you know, if we are judgmental with men, we transmit that, consciously or unconsciously. Men feel that. And when a man feels judged around us, he certainly won't open up to you, because all he'll do is get shot down. But if a man feels unjudged, he's free, he's able to be himself, and when he's able to be himself, he's able to see himself, and then he's able to make changes and grow. But if a man is defensive and has to protect himself from getting shot, well, then he certainly can't stop and freely examine what he is. When a man fouls up, there's always a reason. And if you ever want to annihilate a person, blast him before you find out why he did what he did. There's a guy in our country who was a very promising young disciple, really making progress, very gifted. Anything he did prospered, very fruitful. Then he came late to a Bible study, and the next one he missed, and the following one he missed for no good reason, apparently. So we got together and went over to his room, huckered down on his bed and put my feet up on his bookcase, and we began to talk. You know why he didn't show up to those Bible studies? He discovered that he had venereal disease, and he had prayed about it, confessed his sin, had gone to a doctor, tried to get cured, and the cure didn't take. And he took it as a sign from God that God was through with him. Now, that would be a motive for any good guy to miss a Bible study, wouldn't it? Now, what do you suppose would have happened to that fellow had I blasted him when I first came in to see him? Now, that's a subject, the fact that a man has venereal disease, that's something that you don't wear on your sleeve. You don't go around telling everybody that you have that problem. But communication had been established, and he felt free to share with me what was going on in his life. And because he had that freedom, that man is a very strong disciple that we are depending on for the future. That system of communication saved that man's life. Another thing that happens when we let people in is that we begin to function as light. Jesus said in Matthew 5, you are the light of the world. How does that happen? He says, as long as I'm in the world, I'm the light of the world. But now you're the light of the world. How is he the light of the world? Because, well, he reflected the glory of the Father. How are we the light of the world? We reflect the glory of the Son. And what happens when we reflect the glory of Christ to another? Well, that other person begins to see what he's like. It's like when we go into the presence of Christ, we're in the light, aren't we? Well, when a person gets into our presence, if we are walking in the light, he is in the light. And what happens? The same process happens with him that happened to us. He begins to see himself as he is. And for a new Christian, those are the first steps of self-discovery that take place. That's where he begins to understand what he's all about, and that is the way maturity takes place. I'm sure that you've had those had experiences like this. Just on my way up here, my travel agent just about blew me out of the water. I made reservations for all of my flights up here, and when it came time to leave town, they still weren't confirmed. So I decided that when I was in Sao Paulo, I would check them out. So when I got to Sao Paulo, I discovered that my ticket had been made out completely, made out all wrong. They had to rewrite all those tickets. It took almost half a day, had a block of tickets like this. And what's more, by chance I discovered that to stop in one city, Beling, and to go on would require that I have a yellow fever shot. And if I didn't get that shot, when I left Beling and touched down in the next place, I'd have to spend 40 days in quarantine. And if that had taken place, you fellows would be spending an hour in silent meditation right now. And it was by chance that I discovered this. So the fellow that I was with says, well, I think we'd better give that travel agent a piece of our mind. I said, boy, that's right. Let's set that travel agent straight. But God began to bother me about that. And finally, a little bit later, I said to my companion, I said, you know, I don't think you should say anything to that travel agent. He said, why? I said, because I have a strong vindictive streak in me. And I don't like it, and I know that God hates it. And I need to get rid of it. And so I just need to take a few injustices on the chin. And you know what my companion said? He says, you know, I have a vindictive streak too. Now, I don't know if he knew that before. But what happens when we are transparent is that other men identify with that. And they see themselves and they begin to make progress and grow. And what happens when we begin to reveal ourselves like this and open our lives, that it becomes a small step for a young disciple to begin to go to the original source of light and get orientation, the Bible. Huh? Tournier says, and I'm quoting Tournier once in a while just to kind of whet your appetite. I hope you begin to read some of the things he's written. He says, the greatest service we can render is to teach one to meditate by our own example so that he can learn to become honest with himself. That's the greatest service we can render. To teach one to meditate so that he can learn to become honest with himself. And of course, in the context of his writings, he's referring to meditating on the scriptures. That's the greatest service we can render. How do we do it? By our example. By seeing, by other men seeing us, relating our own lives to what the scriptures teach us, having our lives conformed to it, and let them see the process take place. And they begin to do the same thing. There are two ways of training men. One is the military way, where you shape up so that you can get that liberty, or so that you can keep the sergeant off your neck. And I know that I've had guys in my home that have shaped up just to keep from getting blasted. Now, the problem with that kind of motivation is that it doesn't stick. But what do we want to do? We want men to arrive at convictions about things. And how do they arrive at convictions about things? They arrive at convictions about things by having experiences which they relate to the scriptures, and they draw conclusions, and the change comes from within. They think then that the standards that they are following are their idea. It comes from the heart. And there's a great difference. The difference is, 20 years later, the man will be following the same standard. And that's important then. Because when we train men, when we disciple men, we need to think in terms of a whole lifetime. What will that man be doing 20 years from now? If he's not bearing fruit, if he's not continuing to walk with Christ, then what's the sense of working with him now? Our job is to seed the world with good seed. And if, when a man leaves our fellowship, he does not go on and bear fruit, then we fail. And so we need to be sure that the changes that take place in the lives of the men that we are training be from within and not from without. Let me give you a few practical things on this. How do we go about this? I'm sure that this is what you're wondering about. How does this affect your method, your process of training men? I think that the rest of the time really will be the answer to this question. The rest of the time that I'll be speaking will be the answer to this question. But for now, I'd like to explain to you how does this affect the man-to-man sessions, where it's just eyeball to eyeball, nose to nose, just you and me, babe. What do we do? Well, we spend time in prayer together. We spend time talking about his ministry or our ministry together. We spend time in some instruction. But most of this is just sort of filler. Because the thing that forms the backbone of our time with men is conversation. And this is something that you have to initiate. We start out, maybe begin to share, I set the tone, begin to share some of the current lessons from God, things that are going on in my life, some of the plans I have, maybe some fears that I happen to have, weaknesses, desires, the good things, the bad things. Well, what happens? The fellow begins to identify with that, because I'm talking about real life. You know how it is. Any conversation goes that way. I start telling you about a fishing story, and what are you doing? You're not really listening to me. You're thinking of one that you could top me with. And so when I stop for breath, you start in on yours, and you tell me about your fishing story. So I've run out of fishing stories, so I'm busy thinking about the best hunting story I can come up with. And so when I get done, when you get done, I start into my hunting story. And so conversation is that, many times. Well, you know that anything that someone says, you think, how does that affect me? How do I relate to this? And pretty soon this process takes place in these sessions with men. The other fellow begins to speak. And when he begins to speak, I shut up. And I let him talk. And when he stops, instead of giving him my next story, I ask him a question. And pretty soon he begins to share things that he had never even been aware of before. And eventually, things begin to define themselves. And he begins to identify the things that he is really concerned about. And I begin to understand what makes him tick and what he really needs. Then we take out a can. Now I don't open it up and pour it out for him. Sometimes I say, here's the can, go find an opener. Or sometimes I just kind of, you know, open it up a little bit at the top and say, here, take this and finish it up. But you know, fellas, you can destroy the thrill of growth if you give a man too much, if you spell everything out for him. We read the works of John Calvin. What made John Calvin the great man that he was? All that study that he went into to write what he did. Well, we need to go through that same process. And not just read the results, but go through the process. And so, we need to remember that discovery is accelerating. And so, we give a man enough, give a person enough clues for him to go on and get the thing that we want him to get. But you know, we can spend an awful lot of time answering questions that the guy is not even asking. And giving him information that he's just not ready for. So before we can give him something, we need to know what he needs. Doesn't that make sense? And so the next time we meet, I say, well, I start with a question. How are you coming on this thing that we've been talking about? And he begins to tell me. And so we go on. And if he hasn't gotten down to the bottom of it, I'll say, well, now, have you thought of this? And have you thought of that? And maybe we'll do it all together. Depends on the situation. Or maybe I'll send him away to get some more by himself. But what we cover is determined by what he needs, not by what I think he needs. Because every man is different. Now here's a bit of heresy for you. In our man-to-man sessions, we have no checkup. You know where I got that idea? From our baby doctor. Our baby doctor gives no shots and performs no operations. He's the children's friend. It's the dirty nurse that gives the shot. Or it's his colleague that gives the operations. The kids love him. Well, if a guy comes around and he knows that I'm going to be going down the checklist to find out how he's doing on everything, he's going to kind of come in ready to get whapped because he's bound to have not done everything perfectly. And he's worried about that. And you know, there are better places to check a man. Why, there's more pressure in a cell group. The dirty old cell group. Let the checkup take place there. And then when you're with a man, it's just person to person. Well, you know, this is hard work, man, working with men like this. And it'll age you fast. Navigators don't grow old. They die young, but they die happy. Because like John said, I have no greater joy than to hear that my children walk in truth. And he says, I tell you these things that our joy may be full. I have got to tell you these things because I'm not complete until I do. And it's rewarding. But boy, does it ever cost. One of the things that I've found that I have to do is to take a day a month and get away and take the list of fellows that I'm working with, which is never very many, about a half a dozen, and I'll pray over each one. And then I'll ask myself the following questions. You might want to write these down. There are five of them. First one is, where is he now? The next one, what does he need? Now, he may need a lot of things. You can come up with a list as long as your arm. But the next one narrows it down again. What is he ready for? He may not be ready for much. So you have to ask, what is he ready for? But there may be three or four things that he's ready for. So you have to narrow it down even further. What's most urgent? And there we pinpoint the thing that he needs right now. And then the next question, how do we get to this? How do I help him on this? And I've also found that I usually need help on this. Because, like Jack says, we use rose-colored glasses when we look at our men. And so Ken Lotus is there, and I say, Lotus, what do you think of Osvaldo? What do you think he needs now? Well, I'll get with Osvaldo, and I'll say, well, how's Dino coming? What do you think he needs now? And we talk about that, and I get help. And then we come up with, how do we get it to him? Another thing that I found absolutely necessary, which maybe I don't even have to mention to you, man, is that before those encounters with those men, I need to spend time in prayer before God. And I find that if I do not do that, everything goes wrong. I can't explain that, but I need to do that. And usually it's a matter of dealing with my own self and preparing my own heart for that man. Well, really what we've talked about here tonight is just the problem of establishing the communication system between two men. It's putting up the lines of communication. I haven't gone much into content, as you've observed. And don't get the idea that I'm saying that all you have to do is establish the lines of communication and training has taken place. No, the communication has only been set up, that's all. I'm not going into the content because you men have the content. And you are well prepared with the content. And so, what I'm trying to do is help you in the area of how do I get the content to the man in such a way that he can really assimilate it and it become a part of his life. And what I'm saying can probably be summed up in 1 Thess 2:8. So being affectionately desirous of you, we're willing to impart not the gospel of God only, but also our very lives because you are dear to us. And training men is dying, giving your life to another man. That's what it's all about. Fernando Gonzalez. A lot of you fellows know him. He's down with us now. He made an observation, which I'd like to pass on to you. I don't know whether it's valid or not. But Fernando spent 4 years up here, close contact with the navigators, and is really a bonus baby for us. This guy is solid gold and will be a tremendous asset to the ministry in Brazil. But he said this. He said, while I was in the States, I learned to organize this business of discipling men. But he said, I'm learning from you to humanize it. Now that's important. Let's pray. Father, we know that this business of discipling men is very much on your heart because it's the one thing that you told your son to do above everything else. And we know that we don't know very much about it. And so I would ask that you would lead us and take these thoughts that we have examined tonight and do with them what you want to do. Help us to forget those things which are irrelevant, but remember those things which could make a difference so that we might apply them. We pray these things in Jesus' name. Amen.